Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
The 14th Amendment, it's a cornerstone of civil rights in America. But if you've been paying attention, you know it's under threat. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. On the books since 1868, the 14th Amendment guarantees fundamental rights, due process, citizenship, equal protection under the law. But a flurry of recent Supreme Court decisions and executive orders could weaken the amendment and strip away some of those rights. Today is actually the 157th anniversary of its ratification. So will this cornerstone of civil rights make it to 158? We talked to Evan Burnick, Associate Professor of Law at Northern Illinois University, and he's author of the book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, Its Letter and Spirit. We were also joined by David Stovall, Professor of Black Studies and Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Professor Burnick kicked things off by explaining, in plain English, what the 14th Amendment does.
The 14th Amendment guarantees pretty much any constitutional rights you might think of that can be violated by the states against being violated by the states. So the rights to freedom of speech, free exercise of religion, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to consensual sexual intimacy, to use contraceptives. All of these are fundamental rights that the Supreme Court has held are guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, which guarantees that no state shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizenship, that no state shall deprive any person of due process of law, protects their life, liberty, and property, and it also protects the government from unreasonably discriminating against particular classes of people. The 14th Amendment was designed to ensure that core fundamental rights that had only been protected against the federal government prior to the Civil War would be protected for all people in all states, and to guarantee non-discrimination, and also to empower Congress to enact legislation to protect those rights and to prevent discrimination.
Yeah, that 14th Amendment, it was one of three amendments that were added as a part of the Reconstruction Act. What was going on then, Professor? What's the significance of that?
So actually, the 14th Amendment was not part of the original plan of Reconstruction. Most Republicans believe that by abolishing slavery, they actually, and empowering Congress to enact legislation in order to establish the freedom of formerly enslaved people, they had all the authority they needed to enact legislation like the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which defines citizenship, lists a bunch of civil rights, and says they're now protected in the states. However, in the immediate aftermath of the ratification of the 13th Amendment, formerly Confederate states did all that they could to, without formally reestablishing slavery, enact legislation known as the Black Codes that were functionally designed to return formerly enslaved people to slavery, and both to establish that those laws were unconstitutional, and also to build a durable infrastructure within the federal government that would ensure that people who were committed to civil rights would hold power for extended periods of time. Right. And at this time, they were Republicans. The 14th Amendment was framed and ratified to establish the freedom that Republicans thought that they had the technical authority to establish under the 13th Amendment, but didn't have the practical ability to without further amending the Constitution.
Yeah.
And then the 15th Amendment is calculated specifically to secure the right to vote, which was a political right that was controversial among Republicans at the time that the 14th Amendment was framed and ratified. And even the most radical of Republicans ultimately conceded that the 14th Amendment did not guarantee that. Therefore, you needed the 15th Amendment.
So, Professor Stovall, good time to bring you into the conversation. Of course, I noticed you nodding as Professor Burnick was running through that explanation for us. But what comes to mind for you as you sort of hear him go through that history? And then when you think about what we're dealing with today?
I think one of the things that's critically important is that our citizenship is always contested. So when we talk about having the right to not be discriminated against, or having the right to have access to certain things, this current moment is telling us that the Trump administration has made a determination that certain people should not have access to those things. And I think because the target that we see optically now being largely Latine populations does not mean that that cannot be enacted upon Black people. And I think that's really important when we talk about particularly the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, because those rights are subject at any given moment.
Can I tell you, I saw an Instagram post recently, and I think I've talked about this on air. It was a video that was making its rounds of yet another ICE sweep up. And it was a Black man. I think he was from Jamaica, to be honest. I remember the person who posted it had a caption that said, "Hey, listen up, Black people. This can happen to you too." And then you saw folks in the comments saying, "How? What do you mean?" Just utterly confused.
Right. I mean, I think that thing around, and as the professor put forward, you can have those rights revoked, right? So earlier today, on Here and Now, they talked about, you know, being denaturalized, and citizenship was a little bit different. But when you think about having these rights as someone born on U.S. soil, now folks saying, well, can, and in the Supreme Court, they're asking this question, can the court actually limit the access to the 14th Amendment of certain populations? So this thing around, and it's not far-fetched to think about this when you have convenience clauses in like the 13th Amendment, right? So enslavement ends except for instances of involuntary servitude for punishment for a crime, right? So this thing around, we have these kind of convenience clauses and you still have this process and practice that people can use to enact the repeal of these things that are supposedly or thought to be guaranteed.
And I want to dig back into that history, Professor Burnick, because though, as we've mentioned, the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, it didn't apply to all states until the end of Reconstruction. Is that right?
Yeah, as a practical matter, it didn't, because the Republicans actually lost power within Congress in a relatively short period of time and then ended up conceding so much to the Democrats in respect of continued federal involvements in protecting formerly enslaved people and their allies in the South that, as a practical matter, by the time that in a an infamous compromise in 1877, where a Republican president, Rutherford B. Hayes, took office at the price of effectively promising that he would withdraw all federal troops from the South, even though at the time racial terror was rampant. And calculated to hobble, these nascent experiments in biracial governments. It was almost a confirmation of where things had been headed past the, this high moment at which you really did have a robust constitutional commitment to biracial republicanism, small r, that a majority in Congress were prepared to act upon.
Right.
So to this point about citizenship being contested, it's crucially important, and it's crucially important to recognize that the 14th Amendment was designed to, in significant part, put an end to contestation. So in the antebellum period, you didn't have a constitution that defined who was and who wasn't a citizen. Mm-hmm. So different states took different approaches.
Interesting.
Most states followed the common law. And under the common law, if you were born in a jurisdiction and you were governed by that jurisdiction exercised civil and criminal law power over you. You could be arrested, detained, sued. Mm-hmm. You had to obey the law, whatever. Then you were a citizen.
Right.
But in the former Confederate states, in the enslaving states, that wasn't so.
That wasn't the case. So then
racialized exclusions of people from citizenship that the 14th Amendment was designed to put an end to and simply say, look, you're born somewhere, you're governed by that somewhere, you're a citizen.
Yeah.
Clear and simple.
So then I want to hear from you both then. What to you would the U.S. look like without the 14th Amendment? You first, Professor Stovall.
I think it would look like a place where certain populations, probably white descended and Western European descended, would be considered a grouping of people to have a certain set of rights, where those who were not part of that group mm-hmm. would have a different set of rights, right? Because, and they could be enforced, like Professor Burnick pointed, they could be enforced in particular ways according to that jurisdiction.
Right. Depending on what state you lived in.
So the South could, even though we still see the marginalization of black people in the South, it could be even worse without the protections of the 14th Amendment.
What's the impact on a place like here, a sanctuary city, Chicago, right? Sanctuary state like Illinois?
Well, I mean, it gets into a situation, as my students like to say, it would be Chicago versus the world, right? So Chicago saying, look, if we can contest this and we will contest this. Now, the point would be, to what extent will the federal government enact what it thinks to be its right to encroach upon the citizenship of folks who are deemed, quote unquote, not supposed to be here, who are here under different or false pretenses. So this, again, it would set up a fight, which is something that Chicagoans are used to.
Yeah, and ready for.
Right, all the time.
All the time. Professor Burnick, your take on that, what this country would look like if we didn't have the 14th?
Well, it would look a lot like the 1880s, and that is not a place that I think anybody should want to return. A place in which, in a patchwork of states, there is some meaningful protection for fundamental rights and civic equality for all people. And a number of states, geographically distributed, mostly in the South, I don't think that's entirely a coincidence, in which that's simply not so. And one of the more frightening things that representatives of this administration, including the actual presidents, has said in recent weeks, involve this suggestion that if a state is enacting certain kinds of laws that are designed to be protective of people who the federal government doesn't want to protect, sanctuary jurisdictions, if a state is doing that, then, well, we just might have the authority to, as is already being done in California, send in the military to, in the words of Christy Noem, liberate that government or the people in that place from what she described as socialist governments. Mm. That kind of language, that idea of duly elected, popularly elected governments being deemed by outside forces to not be functioning governments at all, and therefore ripe for taking over, is very closely and frighteningly analogous to some of the thoughts that animated the movements to sabotage and destroy Reconstruction by racial governments and redeem them by installing white supremacist governments in their place. President Trump just mentioned the possibility that if Zoran Mondani is elected mayor, well, the White House might have some authorities that it could call upon to run things.
Yeah.
That's seriously frightening stuff from a where are we now perspective.
Absolutely. What's going through your mind, Professor Stovall?
Well, I mean, this thing around, there was a Supreme Court case just recently, a couple weeks ago, I think it was decided on June 27th, where the Trump administration made a attempt to repeal the 14th Amendment, but they knew they wouldn't win. So they asked the court to say, well, to what extent can the president actually rebuke or override decisions from lower courts? So this becomes, just as Professor Burnick says, this becomes important because if they can override, if he can override the decisions of lower courts, now he could potentially try to use another legal strategy to further limit citizenship rights. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that Trump actually uses a strategy that outwardly brings chaos, but inwardly is really just a spaghetti on the wall theory. Let's do as much as we humanly can and see what sticks. And if this thing sticks, then we're going to push it as much as we humanly can. But if it doesn't, we'll back off until we can do something else, back to the point of chaos.
So interesting to hear someone say that out loud. I found it interesting that you told Reset producer Sienna that the current push that we're seeing right now to reinterpret the 14th Amendment, the spaghetti on the wall, as you just described, this is partially a response to what we saw in 2020, the George Floyd protests. Say more on that.
So what we see are conservative pundits, people from conservative think tanks like Christopher Rufo, who literally say publicly, when we saw 2020 and we saw the racial calculus shift in the United States, we knew that there was very little we could do to reverse it. So now that we have an opportunity to interrupt that shifting of the racial calculus, now we will do all that we can to suppress the rights of those we deem to be dangerous to us, right? So this is a push around. So if you think about any regulatory power that is enacted by governments on police forces, reversing that. Anything around a just immigration policy, reversing that. Returning schools back to places that focus on patriotism over fact and accuracy. So this idea of, and literally in some of the rhetoric from conservative pundits, taking back the things that were lost, right? So it goes back to an older space where people used to talk about the Civil War in terms of the cult of the lost cause, right? The lost cause being the attempt to keep enslavement. So this thing around, we are in a current moment where folks have made a conscious attempt to reverse all the things that would be considered racial progress or racial justice.
Professor Burnick, all this talk about birthright citizenship, I wonder if first-generation Americans should be concerned too. What do you say?
So, as a constitutional matter, to the extent that anybody cares about the original meaning of the constitutional text, cares about that history, cares about Supreme Court precedent, cares about consistent all three branches of the federal government practice since 1898 when the Supreme Court first forthrightly affirmed birthright citizenship, This is an easy case. Birthright citizenship is guaranteed by the Constitution. The exceptions to birthright citizenship are extremely narrow and don't look anything like the scope of the exceptions that the anti-birthright order would create. But as a practical matter, this administration has, you know, a lot of this stuff seems chaotic and sloppy, and it is, but it has a constitutional vision. It's an inverted constitutional vision from the standpoint of Reconstruction and from the standpoint of the 14th Amendment. It frankly turns it on its head and turns it from a charter of empowerment and full citizenship into a charter of domination and exclusion. But they really believe this stuff. They really believe that citizenship in this country should be a more of a function of your ancestry, as determined with reference to, as you know, J.D. Vance put it just yesterday. Can you point to ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War or in the Civil War on either side? Well, if you can, you're more American than foreign nationals. And what I worry about, particularly in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in just a couple of weeks ago, is that even though eventually the Supreme Court will get around to holding this executive order unconstitutional, first of all, they might not. Second of all, in the meantime, the Trump administration is going to be pushing on absolutely every front to make this unconstitutional policy as effective as possible in as many places as possible until that time.
Right.
And in the meantime, people are going to be harmed. Constitutional rights are going to be violated in irreversible ways. Mm-hmm. They will change how people perceive this country and their place within it. And so that eventual victory, and I still expect it, is going to come too little too late for too many people.
Is this all doom and gloom, Professor Stovall? Like, is there some light at the, give me something. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel here? Because I mean, We've been watching since January. President Trump's been handed significant wins by the Supreme Court,
right,
which is bad, but is it like really bad, catastrophic?
Right. I mean, I think to Professor Burning's point, we need to pay attention. We need to be clear around the seriousness of it. But we also need to ask a different historical question, right? What does it mean to live in a land founded on enslavement, genocide, wrongful appropriation, and settler colonialism, right? We have to come to grips with that. And I think in the United States, we've been engaged in this thing. We constantly divert that until we're confronted with it. So now we're confronted with it. And now we have to say, well, this is what it has been for a long time, given some interruptions. And I think I won't call it a silver lining, but I think the thing that encourages me is a willingness of people not to take this, right? A willingness of people to fight. And to say, look, these things are problematic, they are unacceptable, and we will work not only to defend them, but to build something new. And I think that is the important piece. Like, we are in a fight.
Yeah.
The first thing is we have to act like we're in a fight.
That's the glimmer of hope.
Right.
We'll leave it there. That's David Stovall, who's professor of Black Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and Evan Burnick, who's associate professor of law at Northern Illinois University. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Sienna Greaves and Gina Montagna. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Sienna. To never miss a conversation, you can hit subscribe wherever you listen or find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.